From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as we dig out from the weekend storm, what's ahead?
Well, we are done with the main part of the storm. Now we have the bitterly cold air coming in, so we get what only Michigan gets and a few other places, lake effect.
Plus, what will the new year hold for the American automakers?
2013 came in 15.6 million vehicles sold. That compares to 14.5 million in 2012. And then we think that it could be as much as 16.4 next year.
And the man he became, how FDR defied polio to win the presidency.
He wanted to be seen standing and walking, as he could do with assistance. A wheelchair was a symbol of invalidism, of poor health.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's very good to be with you on this snowy, snowy winter day. Certainly hope you're staying warm. On today's show, an auto forecast, more electric cars. What about increased sales in a recovering economy? And what about that dreadful European market? Just what will 2014 hold for the industry that still powers our state? Then later in the hour, Michigan author James Tobin is here. We'll talk with him about his new book, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. But first, well, this time the forecasters did not cry wolf. We got slammed, but good. Now that the snow fell and fell and fell, we've got the winds and that dangerous cold. What's ahead, and when will we see something resembling a more typical Michigan winter? Let's turn to MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who also runs farmerweather.com. And Mark, I have to tell you, I just got back yesterday from nearly 2 weeks in Ireland, and we were there in County Cork checking on your reports as we got ready to fly back yesterday, wondering, would we beat the snow and would we be able to land? And the answer was yes and yes. And you, my friend, were spot on in calling what was going to happen and why. Way to go.
Well, thank you. And they've had some nasty weather over there, I've heard.
We had the worst storms in Ireland in 15 years. We had winds at the top of our little hillside at 160 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, I heard there was some craziness over there. It's wacky all over.
It is crazy. But thanks to your good forecasting, we knew that we were going to be able to get in before the worst of the storm hit. So are we done with the big snowfall?
Well, we are done with the main part of the storm. Now we have the bitterly cold air coming in, so we get what only Michigan gets and a few other places, lake effect. Mm. So, you know, it's kind of like the analogy I use is when you're driving through the suburbs of Detroit, sometimes you cross a line and you don't know if you're in one suburb or the other. In this storm system, the main brunt of it is over, but the snow will continue in spurts off and on, and I think we could see on the west side of the state, another 4 to 8 inches today and tomorrow. And on the east side of the state, it's rare that lake effect even makes it over toward the east side and accumulates much. 2 to 4 inches is possible there. So you'll still be shoveling.
Oh, boy.
When will it be all done?
Yeah.
It will be all done, it looks like, probably midnight to 6 a.m. Wednesday morning. And Wednesday actually starts a huge turnaround where we're going to have temperatures above freezing by the time we get to the weekend.
That is hard to comprehend when we're looking at these wind chills and the real temps. It's just unbelievably cold.
It is. These are dangerous wind chills. This looks like it's the coldest air we've had in about 20 years. 1994 was the last really cold outbreak. 1994 lasted longer. It lasted about 7 days. This one's only about 2 or 3 days long. But as far as this brand of cold, it's been a long time since we've had to face this.
In fact, overall, can you compare this storm to other storms in Michigan's past in terms of either record snowfall or these very, very cold temperatures? Where does this one stand?
Well, it depends on where you're at. The heaviest snow in this one fell from about Flint, southwestward through Lansing, down toward Kalamazoo. And it looks like somewhere around the Lansing area to the Flint area had the heaviest, between 16 and 18 inches. Flint reported 17.1 so far, and that makes it the third largest snowstorm ever in the Flint area. Now, you go south of there, Detroit, Ann Arbor, not as much, 8 to 10 to 12 inches. Detroit is reported its 24th largest snowstorm ever. So if you're in Lansing, if you're in Kalamazoo, if you're in Flint, yeah, it's a biggie. If you're north and south of that 100 miles, it's a decent Michigan snowstorm with a whole lot of cold behind it.
Now, Mark, you've been talking about this cold Canadian air, this vortex of cold Canadian air. You've been telling us about that since November. Is this what's behind the dangerous wind chills we have right now?
Yes, it is. The polar vortex actually has dropped all the way down. Normally, in a cold time period of winter, it would be centered over Hudson Bay. That center today is riding right over the northern part of Michigan. So it is 500 to 1,000 miles farther south than normal. And again, the fortunate thing is it's not sticking around. By Wednesday, it'll already be up to Hudson Bay, and by the weekend, it'll be back to where it should be, up around the North Pole.
And may we just say, don't let the door hit you on the way out, polar Canadian vortex.
Yes, exactly. And you know what's interesting is I'm starting to get the hints, and I'm starting to just wonder about this. Is this going to be one of these things where we use up the cold halfway through the winter and we flip-flop? And the reason why I say that is when I look at all the data that goes out 16 days,
yeah,
I think we're almost going to average a little bit more above normal in temperature than below normal in temperature in the next 16 days. And that would be a change from what we've had in the last couple of months.
Well, you're answering the question that I had, which is, do you foresee more big storms ahead for winter 2014?
I think we will have more winter storms. I think the cold will come back. I'm not sure just yet. So we're going to say, I don't really know just yet. We're going to have to wait and see.
Well, it must feel good to be so right when so often Michigan makes such a liar out of hardworking weather forecasters like you.
Well, you know what? One thing is the field of meteorology is incredible. All the variables, and it's not me. It's the meteorologists, the researchers, the government meteorologists that do this computer modeling, the universities, they all work together. There are hundreds of variables in a weather forecast, and now we're talking about these kind of storms 3, 4, 5 days out, and if we're wrong, we're wrong by a few inches and by 50 miles or so.
Yeah.
If medicine could do the same thing, and I'm not saying they don't, but medicine has increased dramatically too, but if medicine and a lot of other sciences could do the same thing as meteorology, we'd have a lot of problems solved.
All right, now here's our final question. What does a meteorologist like Mark Torregrossa do to play on his snow day?
Well, you know, prior to being on an MLive, which I love, I was on television for 25 years. I've never, ever had a snow day in my life until yesterday and today.
Well, how's it feel?
It feels awesome. I mean, I love the internet format because I can update all the time whenever I need to. And I'm working from home. A little secret, occasionally I was in my sweatpants and slippers, too.
See, snow days can be a good thing.
That's right. I'm enjoying them now.
MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa, who also, of course, runs the website farmerweather.com. And we'll be checking in with you, I'm sure, as all of this plays out. Mark, thanks so much. And again, thanks for those great forecasts that got us securely from Ireland to Detroit, despite the storms.
Good. Glad you made it home.
There was an important vote today as members of Detroit City Council chose a new leader. Councilwoman Brenda Jones edged out previous council president Sawtelle Jenkins. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick has been following this vote for city council president. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Cindy.
So for those who aren't intimately familiar with the members of Detroit City Council, tell us a little about just who is Brenda Jones.
Well, at this point, Brenda Jones is, I believe, the longest-serving member of the Detroit City Council, and she is very closely tied to the city's unions, and she also was, along with former council member Joanne Watson, one of the sort of core group of council members who really opposed any state intervention in Detroit, from the consent agreement all the way on through to, obviously, the bankruptcy. But so she, you know, people look at her of, I guess, at this point, the fair way to characterize it would be as being of the old guard.
Being of the old guard. And Sawtelle Jenkins, who had preceded her as president, was more moderate, wasn't she?
Yes, she was perceived to be that way.
Yes.
I think she, you know, a lot of this is a matter of tone, but also of substance, because, you know, Sawtelle Jenkins had voted for the consent agreement back in 2012. But, you know, she had also been at various points, as all council members were, pretty critical of both the mayor, which is at some point usually city council members are, but
sure.
also of Kevin Orr, the emergency manager.
Well, knowing that there really has been one of the most vocal critics of Kevin Orr now chosen as council president, what do you think Brenda Jones' election as president means in terms of cooperation between city council and Kevin Orr?
It's quite hard to say at this point because I think everyone's still sort of getting a feel for the lay of the land in terms of, first off, how much city council is really going to be able to do. And then I think Mike Duggan, the new mayor, is going to be really important in terms of setting the tone in terms of his engagement with council and how much is the council going to be able to engage with him and therefore have any sort of say in the process. But elected officials are kind of sidelined at this point in time anyway. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it's almost more of I don't want to say, you know, kabuki, but they're very limited in terms of what the elected officials can do. So I think that there may very well be a more contentious relationship with Kevin Orr, or they're you know, that things just may sort of kind of coast along as they have been, which is with the council doing what it's supposed to be doing, but at the end of the day not having much of an impact on the city's overall direction.
Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick. As always, Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was our 32nd president, and on his inauguration day, in the darkest days of the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt set out a timeless challenge to Americans.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
That was a challenge that FDR was forced to learn in a most personal way as he overcame polio, which left him paralyzed in 1921. What was unquestionably a personal tragedy became a force that helped shape Franklin Roosevelt into a leader who guided the nation through the Depression and through World War II. That transformation is the subject of a new book from Michigan-born historian James Tobin. Its title, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. Welcome back to Stateside, Jim. Very good to have you with us.
Thanks, Cindy. Good to be here.
You know, for most of us who grew up post-Salk vaccine, and I'm one of them, I remember us going to the school and being given the sugar cube and being very relieved that it wasn't a shot that we were getting. As
me
a little
too.
Child, you were
me
afraid
too.
You were going to get a needle. It is a different world for all of us today than America in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. That fear of polio was so pervasive, wasn't it?
Right. And it really, polio became worse and worse in the years after FDR became sick. So that really, the peak of the epidemics were in the 40s and 50s. So when we were kids, that was when the fear of polio was the highest.
And actually, as you point out in your book, it was improvements in hygiene and cleanliness that actually led to this. How was that?
Yeah, it's a strange deal. Yeah. But the poliovirus is endemic in the human environment. That means it's everywhere.
Okay.
But the thing is that when little kids would catch the virus as infants, maternal antibodies and their own immune systems would fight it off, and then they would have lifelong immunity. As sanitation improved, and it's passed through human waste, but as sanitation improved, fewer and fewer and fewer kids were exposed to it at that very young age. And so if you weren't exposed to it and then you got the virus later on, you were more likely to become sick. And that's why the age of infection also became older.
So it's a public health improvement came at a price.
Yeah. Unintended consequences.
Mm-mm-mm.
Classic case.
So take us to August 1921 and tell us how did FDR actually contract polio?
Well, we can't speak with 100% certainty. But if you look at the timing, it becomes very clear with perhaps 98% certainty that FDR caught the virus at a Boy Scout campout on July 28th of that summer, 1921. He was chair of the New York area Boy Scouts, mm-hmm. and went up to a state park on the Hudson River. And then 10 days later, 12 days later, he began to experience symptoms. That's the incubation period for polio. So he almost surely got it by one of two ways, either from a Boy Scout who was carrying the virus, perhaps without being sick himself, or from polluted water at that state park. And I was able to find public health documents that showed that the waters there at that state park were tainted.
And then that incubation period passes. And what, it just started with little aches and pains?
It started with flu-like symptoms.
Okay. Yes,
aches and pains in his back, and he began to run a fever. Okay. It took another day or two for him to experience any weakness and then finally paralysis.
Well, it is stunning to read your book and see how quickly this disease progresses and the polio took over his body, starting with those chills. Would you read an excerpt for us?
I will. This is just after he had had the first experience of symptoms, August 10th, 1921. Colonies of the poliovirus were now creeping upward through the spinal cord. The ensuing war between these viral invaders and the body's immunological defenders resulted in severe inflammation inside the spinal cord. The roaring inflammation, in turn, aroused the sensory nerve cells. For Roosevelt, the result was shooting, shocking pain in every one of the affected muscles. Adult patients have compared the sensation to having nails hammered into one's flesh or to having one's teeth drilled without an anesthetic. Hallucinations and nightmares are not uncommon. During the afternoon of August 11th, FDR leaned forward, began to stand up, and then stopped. His right knee now seemed too weak to support his weight on that side. He lay back down. By evening, he was feeling the same weakness in his left knee. When he awoke the next morning, Friday, both legs felt rubbery and flimsy. It wasn't that he had lost sensation. He could feel the fabric of his pajamas against his skin, and when he put his hands on his knees, he could feel his hands. But when he willed his legs to move, they were listless. Rays of pain spread through his back and legs and feet. As the hours of Friday passed, more muscles seemed dormant. He couldn't tighten his buttocks or clench the muscles of his gut. By evening, he realized he could not hold a pencil. There was something the matter with his thumbs. By the time he tried to go to sleep that night, he was unable to stand up at all.
Historian Jim Tobin reading from his new book, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. Now, I've seen it written that for the rest of his life, FDR refused to accept that he was permanently paralyzed. Is that true, or was there more of a dimensional aspect to that?
Well, he certainly refused to accept the idea that he would never be able to walk without assistance. He continued, I think. Well, this is a complicated story.
Yes.
Let me try and step us through it. I think that for a couple of years he thought that he could recover the ability to walk without any braces, without crutches, without canes. Then at a certain point, about 4 or 5 years into his situation, I think he gave up that idea. But he continued to believe that he could regain strength in his muscles and his legs, and he would be able to get around with braces, canes, crutches. In other words, he'd be able to walk even though it was with assistance. When he was elected governor of New York in 1928, he had to make a choice between pursuing his recovery more fully, giving more time to it, or becoming governor, running for governor. And if he were elected, then he wouldn't have that kind of time to spend. So I think at that point he realized, this is about as far as I'm going to go. So in a way, he sacrificed the hope of further recovery for the hope of gaining the presidency.
How did he plunge into rehabilitation? He had been such a virile, vibrant, active, physical guy. How did he wrap his arms around rehabilitation?
Well, at first, the effort was to build up his upper body. And if you just look at photographs, before and after photos from the polio years, the early polio years, you see at first a kind of slender, svelte guy, well-built but not bulked up. Then if you look at 1924, 1925, especially if you see pictures of him in a bathing suit, you realize his shoulders, his chest have grown. That was all the result of exercise with his upper body. He also began to exercise his legs as soon as he could. And when he discovered the mineral pools at Warm Springs, Georgia, he found the ideal environment for that kind of exercise. He also began to work increasingly with physical therapists who helped him a great deal to do the right kind of exercise to regain the kind of mobility that was still within his reach. So it was a process of years and years of working on this.
And Warm Springs, of course, was a part of his life until he – did he not die in Warm Springs?
He did. He did die at Warm Springs in 1945.
I'm speaking with Jim Tobin, historian, who is the author of the book The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency. I'm kind of interested in you explore his relationship with his wife, Eleanor, which had already been badly damaged earlier in their marriage after he had an affair with her personal secretary, Lucy Mercer. Tell us how the polio affected their relationship.
Well, the marriage was under a great deal of strain before he developed this condition. When he got sick, she absolutely came to his side and helped him in every way that she could. Eleanor had had training as a nurse, so she knew how to be literally a nurse to him, and she did so for many months, really. When he began to pursue his recovery in other places, first by taking long houseboat trips in the Florida Keys, and then at Warm Springs, she increasingly sort of sent him off to do that on his own. And she began to pursue her own career in politics. I think that the polio episode meant a kind of further evolution in their marriage, where he was going off on his track and she was able to go off on her track. And so they were mutually supportive, still with deep bonds of history and affection between them. Mm-hmm. But not the kind of intimate marriage that one associates with their very earliest years. And that was the pattern that continued right into the White House.
And you absolutely have to feel for her, and you take us kind of where she is at, kind of trapped between a husband who needed her because of this illness, children, growing children, and a kind of a gorgon of a mother-in-law in Sarah Roosevelt who wanted it her way and couldn't understand the choices that Franklin was making.
No. No, I mean, Franklin was really in the driver's seat there. Traditionally, the sort of lore of the Roosevelts in this period is that there was a battle between Eleanor and Franklin's mother over his future. But that misunderstands Franklin's own self-determination. In that family, he made the decisions about what he was going to do. And it's true that his mother resisted his decision to go back into politics, but he had no interest in her views about that matter.
And he did. He eventually went back. He was elected governor of New York in 1929, and then he becomes president. And you feel this really, the man he became, came through this polio experience.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I began to realize was that polio was really central to the story that he had to tell as he ran for office, making this comeback. You know, before he had been the prototypical man born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And although he had a great name, he had a great presence in politics, it was really the story that he was able to develop as somebody who had been knocked down and come back.
And had suffered.
And had suffered deeply. I think that's what allowed people to now see him as a really sympathetic character who especially once the Depression was underway, somebody who could sympathize with their situation. And that made him all the more appealing a candidate. And people of course, knew that he had been crippled, again, contrary to the conventional wisdom nowadays.
Yes, we seem to think that it had been kind of masked from the public, although they didn't, as you point out, no one saw him in a wheelchair very much.
Well, FDR wasn't seen in a wheelchair because he never came out in public in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And so there are only three photographs of him in a chair.
And that was a conscious decision because...
Well, image? There are a couple of things. FDR did not want – well, for one thing, FDR wasn't in a wheelchair, even indoors very much. Mm-hmm. And movies of FDR have sort of misportrayed this. FDR used a wheelchair only for fleeting moments in the course of a day to get from one room to another. Once he was in the room where he was going, he switched into an office chair or a comfortable chair. So the wheelchair is not the constant presence in his life that people assume. When he was outdoors, when he was in public, if he wanted to approach a speaker's stand, he wanted to be seen standing and walking, as he could do with assistance. A wheelchair was a symbol of invalidism. of poor health. FDR was not in poor health. He just couldn't walk by himself. So the wheelchair, I think, would have sent an absolutely wrong message to the one he had to convey to the public.
And interestingly, that was the one chosen for the statue in Washington.
Yeah, it was chosen for the statue. There's a great statue in London that shows a different FDR. He's standing with a cane. That's the image that FDR was happy to portray. So, I mean, I understand why disability advocates wanted to see him in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. It's not that that doesn't make some sense.
Sure.
But I like the one in London better.
I loved your line that conventional wisdom is that FDR became president in spite of polio. I think the evidence suggests that he became president because of polio.
I do. Yeah. It has to do with that narrative that he was able to develop. Mm-hmm. And polio, in practical terms, also kept him on the political sidelines during the middle 1920s. Which was a time when the Democratic Party was tearing itself to pieces between the so-called wets and the so-called dries, fight over prohibition,
yeah.
Also over religion, over the rise of immigrants in the cities. FDR was able to be at the edge of that battle and come back only when the time was really propitious for him to come back.
He wasn't down in the mud during the 1920s.
Right.
So in a sense, then he was able to come through with that.
Right.
We have that image of him, and certainly bolstered by photos and what newsreel might have existed, the chipper smile, the demeanor that is upbeat, the upturned chin and the jaunty cigarette holder. And yet you write that he remarked to Orson Welles, "You and I are the two best actors in America." Was there a different life for him away from the crowds and the press and the photographers?
Well, no. I think the jaunty FDR that we have in our mm-hmm. popular consciousness, that's the same FDR very much so that people knew in private. So when FDR made that reference to acting, I think it's a blended message. He's talking to some extent about his ability to manipulate people one-on-one by shows of temper or by shows of jocularity. FDR put on the mood and the temperament that he needed in the practice of politics. But it's also partly about polio, to show himself to be – I see this is a paradox.
Yeah.
I think he had to convince himself – convince people, convince the public that he was – the man that he really was when they assumed, when they attached a stigma to him, when they put a mask on him of
invalid.
Disability.
Yes.
Invalid.
Yes.
That's right. He had to show them, no. I am a man of strength and health. But that, in a way, was also a performance.
Interesting. You quoted his aide, Harry Hopkins, "The guy never knows when he's licked." So it's no surprise that FDR went for that fourth term in the White House, but you seem to feel he shouldn't have.
He shouldn't have. FDR by that time was really ill
with
hypertension, heart disease. Mm-hmm. He had no business running for president in 1944. I think that he dealt with heart disease in the same way he dealt with polio in his own mind, which is, I'm just going to get past this. I defeated polio. I'm going to defeat this. But these are two obviously very different diseases.
What most surprised you as you researched this book and learned more about Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Well, I suppose it was the fact that from the very beginning after he contracted polio that he never let down that optimistic approach. I was going to say facade, but it wasn't just a facade. Mm-hmm. I think he insisted on that approach in his own mind. This was going to be all right. He was not going to let this defeat him. Now, that is not, I learned, an atypical response to trauma and severe loss. That's how many people respond in this sort of situation. You know, and it works. I talked to a terrific physical medicine specialist at the University of Michigan, James Richardson. And when I asked him about denial as a way of coping with this kind of traumatic illness, he shrugged his shoulders and he said, "What's wrong with that?" He said, "For a lot of people, that works." And it certainly worked for FDR.
It's a wonderful book, The Man He Became, How FDR Defied Polio to Win the Presidency, by Michigan-born historian James Tobin. Always a pleasure to talk with you on Stateside. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The 2014 North American International Auto Show is right around the corner. Reporters from around the world will descend on Detroit's Cobo Center next week for the media preview days. The huge Black Tie Charity preview is on Friday the 17th, and the doors open to the public on Saturday the 18th. With that in mind, we wanted to talk about what the upcoming year might bring for the auto industry. And for that, we turn to Michelle Krebs from Edmunds.com. Welcome back, Michelle, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Glad to be back.
And we're joined by Michigan Radio's automotive reporter, Tracy Samilton. Always good to have the two of you together.
Howdy.
So let's start with the overall health of the U.S. auto industry as we start this new year. Michelle, I'll start with you. What are you expecting in terms of both sales and profits for 2014?
Well, we think it'll be another good year. 2013 came in 15.6 million vehicles sold. That compares to 14.5 million in 2012. And then we think that it could be as much as 16.4 next year. So another really good year. It'll be a strong year for trucks, and that all means better bottom lines.
And the only warning sign there, and Michelle and I have talked about this a lot, is what's going on in the supplier industry. They are really having trouble keeping up with this demand right now. They haven't hired as much as perhaps they should have. They're competing with the automakers for engineers right now. Hmm. There's an engineer shortage, and their facilities haven't been invested in as much as perhaps they should have. And so there's a real concern that we might have a part or two come up short, and you can't ship a car without all the parts.
So that will be something to watch for. And again, that's just a matter of business is almost too good for where after they ratcheted down during the recession.
That's right.
Right. It's like a rubber band, and the tiniest thing could make it snap.
Where would you both say the big three would be in terms of a comeback? If you were graphing it, are they at the apex? Are they still ascending?
They're close, I think. You know, if Michelle's prediction is correct for 2014, that is very close to the pre-recession level of auto sales. I would say the great thing about it is that this time they're not using incentives nearly as much to reach that level.
Good point.
I would agree. I think that while 16 million is kind of this magical number milestone that everybody looks at, and I think we'll surpass that next year or this year. And that the last time we did that was 2007. There were some years before that we were at 17 million, 18 million, very artificially driven by incentives and ridiculously available credit beyond what was sensible. So I think we are in a far healthier state. And remember, when we were selling 17 and 18 million vehicles a year, the big three were struggling to make a profit.
That's right. They were losing a lot of money. You're right.
Now, we should note any good news in terms of sales and profits is thanks to the North American market and absolutely no thanks to Europe. Mm. Is that true, Michelle?
That's absolutely true. Europe has been a real drag on any global automaker. Look at Fiat. Thank goodness they have Chrysler. But things may be starting to turn in Europe. It's going to take a little bit of time, but it looks like we've hit the bottom and we'll move up. And it looks like, you know, sales around the globe are going to be better next year. So that should be better for everybody, or you know, all the global automakers, of which the big three are included.
I would be interested to see whether anyone is successful in closing plants in Europe. Because they still have too many, way too many. So they just, you know, the political environment there for closing plants is different, and it does make it really difficult to come out of that recession.
Something to watch for in 2014. Well, let's move on to, we do our top 10 list. We're moving to item number two, and that's people. And let's start with GM, as we see Mary Barra, the first woman to achieve the CEO spot for an American car company. What do you expect to see from her in 2014, Michelle?
Well, it's going to be interesting. I'm not quite sure what we'll expect to see. I think we'll see General Motors moving along as it has been. And let's remember, along with Mary Barra being named the first female CEO of any auto company, including General Motors, in the same month, GM shed all the government ownership. So we truly are at a different kind of General Motors, and we'll see where that new GM goes.
I think if You know, if we're expecting Mary Barra to be this charismatic CEO, we may be disappointed. She's a very low-key type of person. She's very similar in a way to Dan Akerson, who was a very low-key person. Sometimes the auto beat folks, you know, the media are like expecting this. They love to write about the CEOs. So there's going to be a little bit of disappointment there, perhaps.
But if she's getting it done.
If she's getting it done, that is what matters.
Moving on to item number three, and that's that roller coaster called Tesla, which really sets the stage for us to have a conversation about how EVs are doing. Now, first of all, Tracy, take us back. Tesla's had a real roller coaster ride. What's been going on?
Well, their stock has been, most people agree, just ridiculously high for the value of the company. Just way, way overvalued. And you know, a lot of people have been expecting to see a crash. We haven't seen that, but we have seen it coming down and going back and forth. And then we've had these, how many fires, Michelle?
Two or three.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, you know, fires happen in regular cars, but when you talk about an electric car, it gets a huge amount of media attention. And then there's Elon Musk, who runs Tesla, and he will create media attention if he isn't getting any. He will make sure he gets some. So it's just, it's such a tiny company to be getting such a huge amount of attention.
And if we talk about EV sales, why are they not good? Is it the fact that the technology isn't where it needs to be for the public to really embrace EVs? Or
well, they're expensive. They're compared to a regular car. They're limited in what they can do. You can't drive from, you know, Ann Arbor to California and back in a pure EV.
Mm-hmm.
There's just natural limitations for the cars. And it reduces the demand.
Right. What we saw this past year is some of those prices were cut, and yet we still didn't see the sales go up. Typically, when you see a price cut, you see sales go up a lot, but that's not been the case.
If you've just joined us, that was Michelle Krebs from Edmunds.com, who's also joined by Michigan Radio's automotive reporter Tracy Samuelton, as we kind of look at what was big in auto news in 2013 and looking ahead to what will be big in 2014. And we move to the next item on our greatest hits list here, and that's Chrysler with that on-again, off-again IPO. Michelle, what is behind that?
Well, when Chrysler came out of bankruptcy, the VEBA, which is the mechanism that the takeover by the union of its health care costs for retirees,
right,
acquired a big chunk of stock of Chrysler. Chrysler Fiat, actually, which is the parent of Chrysler, has been trying to buy that so that they could do an IPO. They've had a huge debate about the price of it. And finally, on New Year's Day, as we were all watching football and hockey,
yeah.
Chrysler announced that it had come to an agreement with the union about the price of that. And so now Chrysler becomes fully owned by Fiat and moves forward here.
And a lot of people think, Mr. Marchionne got a pretty good deal. Overall, he spent about $6.3 billion total, including this most recent transaction for Chrysler. Cerberus spent $7.4 billion to take Chrysler off Daimler's hands. Daimler spent $36 billion. So
pretty good deal.
It looks like a good deal. Of course, the value of the company has been hurt.
Yes.
In that time.
Moving to the fifth item on our list, Ford Motor Company, in particular, Alan Mulally. Whither goest, Alan Mulally? Michelle, are those rumors about Microsoft? Do they have legs?
Oh, well, it's had legs in the media, I can
tell
you that.
Yes, it has.
You know, this has been just a haranguing story throughout the year. Is Alan Mulally going to become the next CEO of Microsoft? And he's been a little bit vague about that. He keeps saying he's staying at Ford, but it's not been real firm. I think we'll probably know in the next month or so. Microsoft has said it will announce who the next CEO is. I'm not sure how that will turn out. But I think for the company, it's been a big distraction. And Ford's introducing a lot of new product this year, and I have said that they really need to get the focus off Mr. Mullally and get it onto their products.
Which actually kind of leads us to the next item on our list, and the fact that Ford gained more market share than anyone in 2013. But that sure didn't come easily, did it, Tracy?
No. They're doing very well. The cars that they're selling are being sold at a premium. They're doing really well in terms of getting high transaction prices per car. My sense is that they're still getting some benefit from not having taken the government bailout money. But they've had some big embarrassing things happen, like with their Escape launch, 6 recalls for one car.
Big launch.
And they had to downgrade the miles per gallon on their C-Max, their hybrid C-Max, and that was really embarrassing.
And there have been glitches. I know MyTouch was really...
Still.
Not
a problem.
Was. Still a problem. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln. Poor Lincoln.
Mm. Yeah, what do you think, Michelle? I'm going to throw that at you.
Well, Lincoln's got a tough go. They introduced the MKZ as their first product of the new Lincoln. And then we'll see it this next year, the MKC, which is a little sport utility. They're coming late to the luxury party, part of it because they didn't have the money to do anything with Lincoln. When it was in its Ford had focused on the Ford brand to get the sales and profits up.
Which is understandable.
Totally understandable, but, you know, it's going to be a slow, difficult slog. I would say, you know, it's going to take a decade or so and a lot of money. The other thing that I think that I'm concerned about plaguing Ford is the launches. The product launches have been very glitchy. They had problems launching the Lincoln MKZ. They announced it in December. It didn't get on the market till spring. There have been some problems, quality problems, and they have not gone unnoticed. My concern with that is, yes, Ford sales are strong. Their pricing is strong. But will shoppers come back to the brand if they have constant troubles with their vehicles?
And I think they're well aware of that. Mark Fields apparently is now holding not just the famous Thursday meetings where they get a whole picture of how the company is doing in just a few hours, but he's holding extra meetings now on Wednesdays simply focused on these launches and quality control. And Mark Fields is in line, we believe, to become the next CEO. So I think they're aware of it, and I think they're working on it.
Moving on to item number 7, and that is something that we've talked about here on Stateside as well. And I'm curious what you guys both see ahead in 2014 for driverless cars. Michelle?
Oh, I think we're going to see. There was a lot of talk and focus on autonomous cars, driverless cars this past year. There's a lot of technology already on the cars that can make that possible. And I think we're only going to hear more and more about it. There's a lot of Governor Snyder just signed into effect a law that that will allow testing of driverless cars. There's a lot of the whole connected car experiment that's going on in Ann Arbor. We're all leading up to that. There's a lot of work to be done before it can actually happen because a lot of public policy has to be established, safety, things like that. But we're on our way towards the path to that.
It's going to be a while before these technologies sort of trickle down to less expensive cars. But we see luxury cars now often offering things like automatic braking, and if you if you veer out of your lane, it'll bring you back in, things like this. And when it does happen on a large scale, I mean, we're going to be seeing a big, I think, reduction in deaths and injuries on the road, because people are really not that good at driving cars.
Well, it might start if we could put down the phones, get
exactly.
them out of our hands, and get our eyes back up on the road, but that's a whole other topic. That was Michigan Radio's automotive reporter, Tracy Samilton, and she's also joined by Michelle Krebs from Edmunds.com. As we kind of look at what the upcoming year might bring for the auto industry, stories we might be looking at as 2014 goes on. And another story is that of millennials shunning cars. We have had people on this show who staunchly believe that millennials are keeping away from owning cars. And what do you each think about that? Is it a myth, or is there something to this?
I think it's a myth. And the numbers concede that they are slower at getting into the car market, but there are lots of reasons for that, and it's mostly economic. If you ask millennials if they want a car, they will tell you they do.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been hurt most by the recession. They're burdened with huge college debt. So they're very, and they're very, they're behind on everything. They're behind on forming households. So I think, you know, when they start forming households, you'll see their buying of vehicles pick up. Now, it could change the way, you know, we're seeing more car sharing like Zipcar and that kind of
thing.
The way they go about buying cars, I think we'll have to, might have to adapt.
All right, moving on. You've got your eyes fixed on some hot products. Let's talk, because that's always fun, talking about what's hot and what's coming up. Thoughts, please, on the Chevy Corvette.
Beautiful.
I love it. I'm a juror on the North American Car of the Year awards. I'm kind of betting that might be this year's winner. It is just it's
stunning.
It's beautiful. It's a technological wonder. And while, you know, you may think it's real expensive compared to a lot of other sports cars that are in the, you know, Porsches and Jaguars that are over $100,000, it's a bargain.
How about this $29,000 Mercedes?
Well, I think that's a game changer. You're going to start that is doing well. And we saw in the Super Bowl, Mercedes advertised a $29,000 Mercedes was coming. It's called the CLA. They're going to do a little crossover based on that same thing. You're going to see BMW and Audi come out with smaller, less expensive cars. It's this whole move for the luxury market to try to get the millennial buyers, younger buyers, into their vehicles. And it's going to be interesting to watch. It'll make luxury more accessible.
In doing that, exactly what you just said, Michelle, it'll make luxury more accessible. Isn't the whole idea of luxury that it's kind of not accessible
exclusive?
And it's kind of exclusive and somewhat rarefied? Will it cheapen these brands?
Well, that's kind of what I am wondering. That is what I have been wondering, is that, you know, how are the folks who tend to like luxury cars because they are exclusive, how are they going to react to that? So.
Well, that I think that is the interesting test, and I think it's interesting to see a luxury brand move down market. It almost may be easier to move more up market. And we've seen, you know, companies like Hyundai and Kia try to move up market. You know, it's very difficult to stretch the band of your brand.
And I just want to mention one car that maybe we'll see by the end of 2014, and I'm really hoping, because it's at the far end, it's the opposite end of what we've been talking about, and that's the Elio. I'm just really crossing my fingers that they find the money to make this car. Never heard of it,
no,
right? It's a two-seater car that could potentially, a three-wheeled vehicle.
Really?
Supposedly safe on the highway, 84 miles per gallon, supposedly. And they're planning to sell it for $6,800. Potentially, you know, something that low-income people use to actually own a new car for the first time in their lives. And there's a whole, you know, it's very up in the air, because getting a car like that on the road, very expensive enterprise to do it. So, and any number of problems could happen, but I really hope they make it happen.
Well, this is fun, as always. We love getting together and talking cars with Tracy Sambleton, Michigan Radio's automotive reporter. Thank you, Tracy. And from Edmunds.com, Michelle Krebs. It's always a pleasure to have you both on the program.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.